The Daily Connect Podcast.
This is the Daily Connect Podcast for Wednesday, the 28th of November, 2018. And coming up, we are going to hear more about RNIB's 150th anniversary. And we're going to be talking about accessible technology as we have moved into RNIB's 150th year. It's time to look back at some of the technology of the past and look to the technology of the future and how it could help us as blind or partially sighted people. We'll also be checking in with British Blind Sport to find out about their upcoming Christmas appeal, and we'll hear about a blind female lawyer from Ethiopia. But first, some campaign news, courtesy of Alan Russell.
November 2018 is Action for Access Month, and it's a campaign by Guide Dogs. Now, to tell us a bit more about the campaign itself, we have with us Hannah Trusler. Thank you for joining us, Hannah.
Hi. So we've chosen this month to be our Action for Access Month, as it's been 2 years since a bill to prevent assistance dog owners being turned away from taxis and minicabs met a red light in Parliament. And we are hoping to continue to keep up the pressure on the government by asking people to contact their MP. We do unfortunately still hear from assistance dog owners all the time that unfortunately they're being turned away from taxis and minicabs. And as we all probably know, it's actually illegal. What we are calling for, still continuing to call for, is this disability equality training. And there has actually been some recent talk about it within the government as part of their recent inclusive transport strategy. And also in a recent parliamentary debate, there was much talk about getting disability equality training made a requirement for all taxi and minicab drivers. So, like I say, we're hoping for within this month is people connecting with their MP just carries on getting the message across and keeps the pressure up so that we can hopefully get this training made a requirement for all drivers.
You used a word there a couple of times, Hannah, which was talk. It sounds as if there's been a lot of talking. How long have you been campaigning for this?
So as an organisation, we've been campaigning for around about 3.5 years on this issue. We know that taxis and minicabs is the most common place for guide dog owners to be turned away from. So that's why we're focusing on that at the moment. But yeah, like I say, the government stopped the bill getting through. So we feel that that's long enough for them to now start doing something about it.
The local councils obviously look after the taxi licensing and so on. And, you know, if you do have a complaint, it's a good place to go to as well as guide dogs. But you're looking for something for central government here at Westminster to put into place. And would this be part of driver training before they even get their licences?
Yes, that's what we're hoping for. We are working with local councils as well from across England, trying to ask them to make sure that training for their minicab and taxi drivers is part of their, like you say, their conditions of licensing, and also for current drivers when they're being retrained, part of that as well.
Have you had more success locally?
We have, yes. We do know that around about a third of councils require their taxi minicab drivers to have this sort of training, but it's just kind of a bit of a slow process trying to get things through politically.
Taxis may be used quite a lot by guide dog owners or people with sight loss as well. You know, it's an important transport method, especially if you have poor public transport in your area. So it's a crucial for people's independence as well.
Yes, we agree. It's often the most convenient and the most accessible way that guide dog owners can travel. So yeah, we agree with that.
So what are you hoping people will do this month? What's your sort of call to action?
So we have a number of ways that people can connect with their MP. What we are mainly calling for is that people can write to their MP. And we've got quite a kind of unique action at the moment where people leave a message for their MP with us. And then come December, we're going to be printing out all of the messages as actual physical letters and sending them to MPs, because we feel this is a kind of different way to connect with MPs. They get lots of emails from lots of different people in their constituency. So we feel that writing a physical letter is something a bit different that might make them understand that this is a really big issue for guide dog owners.
So once the letters have been sent out and perhaps the MPs have had time to mull them over, will there be a follow-up from guide dogs? What is the next step?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we'll be doing. Like I say, we'll be sending out the letters in December, hoping that the MPs will get back to their constituents within a month or so. And then, yeah, we'll be contacting the MPs as well to find out what they're going to be doing about it.
Okay, so if people would like to take part in this, Hannah, or get more information from Guide Dogs, what's the best way to do that?
Yep, so the best way is probably to contact us by email. Our email address is campaigns@guidedogs.org.uk, or our phone number to call and leave a message is 0118 983 0308. Contact us and we'll be able to get back to you with the best way of contacting your MP. And for general guide dogs inquiries, our website is www.guidedogs.org.uk.
Hannah, best of luck with the campaign. Do let us know how it progresses and some of the feedback as well. But in the meantime, thanks for speaking with us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Lovely, thank you.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Now, Jetsbersh Ngusi was 5 when she went blind. It was a big shock for her and her family, but even more so for members of her local community in rural Ethiopia, many of whom believed that it was a curse that had caused her sight loss. And that was just the beginning of the story. Jetsbersh Ngusi joins me now. Hello.
Hello.
And you're joining us from Nairobi today.
Yes. Abadiako, as we say in Nairobi. Hello.
Hello. Now, taking us back to your story, becoming blind was obviously a great shock, but just how much did it affect your early life?
It did definitely affect my life because a child in the community where I come from is expected to support families quite early. So I started my job in the family becoming a shepherd for the sheep and goats we had when I was 3. So turning blind at the age of 5 kind of made me not to go with my lovely sheep and goats to the field to make sure that they get their water, their food on time. So, yeah, it was not easy, and it definitely affected me.
And you mentioned that in one of the things that I was reading that you lost your value to the family. Can you explain that?
Yeah, because a value to the family, especially for a girl born in that community, would mean that she would bring a dowry and she would bring a very strong son-in-law, because early marriage is the practice, and girl, whenever you have a girl, it's like you have an asset who is supposed to bring a dowry for the family and who is supposed to bring a strong son-in-law who can help farming and also in other field works for the family. So the fact that you're blind would mean that you're not qualifying for this kind of opportunities. And in that case, I was considered invaluable and I was considered like a burden for the family.
And did you actually feel that in yourself then?
Well, I really can't figure out. I really can't remember that because I think I was too early. And honestly, I may not be able to give you the honest answer with my level of consciousness and confidence today.
But ironically, this turn of events actually did lead you on a path to better things, didn't it?
Absolutely. For example, becoming blind opened me the chance that I was not needed in that community. I was no longer going to bring the dowry and the son-in-law that they were wishing. So I was allowed to go to the capital, to the urban area. That way I receive education. Because in the rural area, even though they don't have the access for education, but nobody gives the girls away with the expectation that they should bring the dowry back. So blindness got me the chance to get out of that community because I was no more considered valuable. So I got to get educated and I got to be who I am today, internationally famous, an activist and advocating for the rights of others and myself. So it completely changed my life. I was, blindness came as a blessing just right on time. And it was just as if I won a lottery to get out of that community. For your surprise, I'm the only child who's got education from that generation.
It seems,
and thanks to blindness.
Yeah, it seems amazing to hear you say that because your culture is so different to the Western culture. Did you go to mainstream school then?
Actually, I'm a hybrid. I did my first grade, sixth grade in a special school, because by that time, no blind children were allowed to go to mainstream school. So mainstream schools were not open. So, but after, until grade six, I attended special school run by Catholic nuns who came from UK. So, and then after grade six, because there was no choice, I didn't go. Well, I wouldn't call it mainstream, rather. It was more of an integrated school that I went to until, during my high school days.
And were there a mixture of children with disabilities then at the school, or were you on your own there?
No, it was only blind people in the special school. But in the integrated school, we had quite so many blind children. as well as some deaf children included. But it was a government school which has around 7,000 students, and maybe I would say there were around 20 disabled children.
Now, you graduated from Addis Ababa University as one of the first three female blind law students in Ethiopia. Now, that must have been a tremendous milestone.
Yeah, you know, even once you reach higher education, there are prejudices based on gender. So even though becoming a lawyer was kind of taken for granted for blind men, starting from the 1960s, no blind female students were going to that department because mostly they were kind of considered to fit into the education or sociology. So, yeah, we were only the first three ones who joined the faculty, and everybody was sure that we will be dropped out, we will be kicked out from the department. But I'm so happy that all the three of us finished, and one of them is now working as a prosecutor. One of them is working in the House of People's Representative as a legal counselor, and I'm an international disability advocate. So now we have more than 40 blind female students after our generation. So not only we could graduate, but also we could influence quite so many blind girls to join the department, the law school.
Well, tell us about the Ethiopian Center for Disability and Development, because you co-founded that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Given my experience of isolation and also my experience of discrimination in education as well as life, there were a lot of service delivery organizations, including international ones like CBM, Handicap International, and also the local ones like Cheshire and so on and so forth. But the problem is the mainstream development services were not open. So I was always challenged when I went to education. They tell me, no, we only give education for the normal ones. When I went to health, they tell me that, oh, it's for normal people. So I always got a problem. How am I abnormal? And why am I considered abnormal? So with that experiences of discrimination and my ego for inclusion, we decided to co-found the Ethiopian Center for Disability and Development to bridge the gap between disability and development, and that way development people can have the confidence to walk and to talk about disability, and vice versa, disability people have the understanding as well as the skills to talk about development. So this was a kind of initiative that we did in 2005 when I was still in university, and then now it's more than 12 years since the Ethiopian Center for Disability and Development is operating. So it's mainly working on bridging the gap between disability and development in Ethiopia.
So you obviously face some prejudice along the way. Are things changing now for disabled people?
I could say yes. There are changes, but the problem is the changes are not with the pace that we want them to happen because the train is so fast. Now we have the Sustainable Development Goals. We have the Convention on the Rights of Persons. We have too many tools. I think people are convinced that why we need to be included, why we need to be considered. But I think now we have to show them how. So there is a need for expertise. We disabled persons need to be experts. Now we're done with the argument of why, because now the Sustainable Development Goal is about leave no one behind. So I think we should take the second step, which is responding to how. And this doesn't have a uniform answer. All of us have different needs. All of us have different capabilities. So that's a lot of work.
So there's still much work to do, but changing tack a little, your life, talk about full circle, you have now got married, you've got two lovely children as well, haven't you, two lovely daughters?
Yeah. Now the son-in-law is already in place, so I think my families are happy, even though it's with a bit of a delay because I was supposed to marry when I was 12 and I only got married when I was 28 now, getting educated. And I have now my two girls who I think will be the future of this world and who will be fighting a discrimination of any sort. When you are empowered, then you will reach to where you want and where others want you to reach to. So I'm now educated and I'm not in problem to get married. I'm not in problem to raise my children. So education is key in doing all these things, and empowerment is key. Once people's disabilities are empowered, once they're equipped with the necessary skills that they need for life, then they can be whatever they want to be. They can be pilots, they can be doctors, they can be mothers, they can be politicians. I think that's the conclusion we can make.
Well, you certainly sound like you are a role model to admire. Yethberge Negusi, we wish you all the best for the future, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much for giving me time for all our RNIB listeners.
The Daily Connect podcast.
We regularly chat with the charity British Blind Sport. We highlight lots of sporting events and opportunities up and down the country for blind and partially sighted people of all ages. Now, as we approach the festive period, the charity has its annual Christmas appeal. Now, to tell us more, we have with us Elena McGregor, the chief exec. Elena, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, for our listeners who haven't heard of British Blind Sport, tell us a little bit more about the organisation.
We are the national disability sports organisation that represents blind and partially sighted people right across the UK. And our mission really is to make sport and physical activity opportunities available to the visually impaired community. And sometimes that's through delivery ourselves, through a number of our own events. But importantly is also to work with partners, both from sight loss sector, but also the sporting sector. Sporting sector to help them understand and provide them with tools to educate coaches and teachers to make sport more accessible, and also for the VI community itself to make them aware of what's going on in their local area.
I suppose when you talk about sport and visual impairment, you know, people probably think of things like goalball and maybe blind football, but there are so many sports out there which are accessible. So I suppose you get the opportunity to show people, you know, you can do judo, you can play hockey. You know, it doesn't really matter about your sight condition.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's something that we're very keen to put onto the sports sector as well, is to say, you know, small tweaks to your game or to your equipment for your game can really make a huge difference to making sport accessible. I think we've learned over the years that actually those small tweaks can be done very quickly, but it's actually changing people's perceptions that is the harder thing. We've had people who've been very honest with us and coaches say, I'm not sure how to welcome a VI person into a club. And similarly, we've had VI people say, well, I've had such poor experiences with sport, particularly potentially at school, that I don't think sport's for me. So we try and help both parties by saying, well, actually, you can tweak the equipment, but you need to make yourself accessible. You need to make yourself aware of what you can do to help this person feel welcome. And similarly, we say to a visually impaired person, come and have a go. You know, put past experiences behind you. Come and have a go at something you want to do as well. We're not going to enforce a sport on anybody. We're going to say, come and try. I mean, it could be something like Zumba. We work with even dance teachers who are welcoming visually impaired people into their classes. So there's a raft of things out there. It doesn't necessarily need to be sport. It's just about getting yourself active.
So I suppose you don't even have to think of yourself as a keep fit fanatic or, you know, a Paralympian of the future, because, you know, sport opens up so much. There's not just the health benefits. There's probably things like extending your social circle, improving your confidence, your independent mobility. There's lots of pluses here.
Alan, for me, myself, sport, it's interesting because I'm the CEO of British Blind Sport. And I often say to people, I don't see sport as our end goal. I see sport as the springboard for making change. And you've hit the nail on the head there, because actually being able to get people to become more active, the widening their social circle, developing spatial awareness, particularly amongst our younger members, but growing confidence and empowering people to make decisions for themselves. I don't know about yourself. As a child, sport was enforced upon you at school, whether you were sighted or visually impaired. And I've had very bad experiences of sport as a child, and sport turned me off. But then I found out what I liked to do. And that could be something simple as walking, or it could be tennis, or it could be Zumba, like I mentioned earlier. And actually say, this is to help you feel active and feel better about yourself. And you're right, we're not looking for the next Paralympian. It's fantastic when we have Paralympians. They're such inspiring individuals. But that's not what we're trying to achieve here.
And that attitudinal change, as you said, you know, that spreads to the sports or fitness world in general. You know, people may want to go to the local clubs, the local gym, sports centre, swimming pool. But, you know, one of the barriers to that could be, well, they won't know how to help someone with a visual impairment. You know, I don't feel comfortable going there because they may not feel comfortable. So I suppose, as you say, it's promoting in these areas that can make a huge difference. You know, make things more welcoming. And with visual impairment, you're not looking for massive financial investments to make your sports centre accessible.
No, you're not. And you know, again, over the years, I've been in person now nearly 8 years. And I think I'm constantly learning. We did a project some time ago about training some coaches. And I feel bad about mentioning the sport because the sport in particular has been fantastic in recent years. But we'd worked with archery and we thought we knew what we were doing. We've helped all these coaches and they're really good at archery for VI people now and they're going to make it accessible. And I had a man ring me one day and he said to me, I saw your advertising about archery and I went down to the local club and the girl on reception said, I'm sorry, we don't know how to help with your problem. Now, that really hit home to me. This isn't just about the coaches that we're training and making aware of visual impairment. This is everybody. Because if it doesn't matter if the coach is the best coach in the world. And again, I'm not being critical of archery because I'm sure there's been a lot of experience in a lot of sports like that. But what the point was is our person, our VI person, couldn't get past the first hurdle because somebody on reception didn't know what to do and was scared and unsure and made a statement that was completely inappropriate. So we worked with that club and we enabled all of the staff to help make visually impaired people welcome. And that was a huge learning for us. That was about 5 years ago. The learning is that getting the coach to understand the tools is something. Getting the workforce to understand how to welcome visually impaired people is actually the key as well.
So lots of work being done by British Blind Sport to make sport accessible, achievable, I suppose you could say. And part of that, is the Christmas appeal because BBS is a charity, that takes funds to do all this fantastic work. So tell us about the appeal.
Well, the appeal is really focusing on children living with sight loss. We have a project called First Steps. We ran a pilot in Scotland just over 2 years ago now. And it was amazing. We worked with 120 families and we provide the children with a pack, with an activity ball with a bell in it, a booklet about what activities they can do. It could be rolling the ball, catching the ball. There's stickers that they can put on the ball, give the ball a bit of a personality. It's a jingle ball. And then they have a sticker chart, because all kids love sticker charts, of their achievements. We did a lot of work with that. We worked with physios and play therapists on the activities. We worked with designers to make the activity book something that was readable for people that are partially sighted in terms of using bold colours and bold outlines, etc. And it's been a fantastic project. We had 100% of the parents saying they thought it was a fantastic idea. We had 89% of the children showing improvements in their mobility and their physical fitness. So we know that this works. So we started rolling out a project in Yorkshire with 50 children there. It's all about funding. At the end of the day, Alan, it's all about the bottom line. So I want to help all of the 25,000 children living with sight loss. In an ideal world, all of the children would have this pack. The reality is we're a very small organisation. So we look for regional funding, and we've been very successful with York, and we've got a young lady working up there at the moment doing some great work with families. But this Christmas appeal is really trying to establish a more national approach and awareness to the project and trying to get raise money so that we can buy more and more of these packs and be able to provide them to families. The worst thing in the world is if, the money that we've had for Yorkshire, for instance, which is great and we're very grateful to the funder, is if a family hears about it and let's say they live in Derbyshire and they ring up and say, well, we'd like a First Steps pack. We don't want to be able to turn around and say, well, you can't, you don't live in Yorkshire. And we are looking for funding in other areas. We've just been successful with some packs for the Northwest and for the East Midlands, and we'll be advertising for that post soon. But actually, we want to be in a position where it doesn't matter where you live, you can access the pack.
It's great that it makes such a huge improvement for the children themselves. At an early age, it's crucial to build the confidence and they feel that they can take part in sports, albeit the ball game at first, but what that can lead on to. And also, I suppose, the parents as well. I mean, some of them may be quite hesitant about the little ones with visual impairments taking on ball games and sports. So great to hear that, 100% of parents were loving it.
That's the key for me, and that's the driver for me. I have a child who has a disability. It's not a visual impairment, but I know as a parent of a child with a disability, you do tend to wrap them up in cotton wool a little bit more. Now, if you go back to the children living with sight loss and that particular impairment, you've got to remember that we're all visual learners. Watch your child watching you brush your teeth, and then they try and have a go. You see these things. My daughter didn't crawl until she was nearly two, and a friend brought her 10-month-old down and round, and I've been trying to get my daughter to do it for a long time. And my friend's 10-month-old started crawling, and my daughter copied her. And that was a real pivotal moment in my life. But that's because we're visual learners. So our children are already, when I say our children, I'm talking all of the children of Musala, they're already in a back foot because they haven't necessarily got that. They haven't got that rough and tumble with their brothers and sisters that actually help their core strengths. And then you've got the parents wrapping them up in cotton wool a little bit. I spoke to a lady the other day, an elderly lady on the train. She was chatting to me, and I told her about this particular project. And she said, I've never thought about that. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, if you're 4 or 5 years of age and you can't see and your friends are rolling down a hill or something, or running or playing TIG, or she said, how scary must that be? And I said, absolutely, that will be really scary. So the chances are they may not do it. And then that is affecting their physical well-being and eventually their mental well-being as well in the long term. So I see the First Steps Pack as an absolute crucial part of the early learning for young children living with sight loss.
So the Christmas appeal this year, looking to grow the funding to provide more of these First Steps Packs and all the support that goes with that as well. How does it work then? How do you raise the funds?
Well, we're really lucky that the Big Give, which is a national programme, it's the UK's biggest online match funding campaign, and certain charities are selected. And we've been lucky, very lucky to be chosen. So from midday Tuesday, which is the 27th of November, to Tuesday, the 4th of December, for every pound somebody gives to the campaign, then the Big Give will double it. So our target at the moment is we're hoping to raise £2,500. But in essence, if we are able to do that through the Big Give, we will actually get £5,000. And that will help an enormous amount of children. Each pack costs us about £20. So, you know, you can do the math. We're going to help a lot of kids there. So, for instance, if somebody gives us £25, it's actually worth £50. If somebody were to make a £100 donation, it's actually worth £200. So it's a small give, really. If you give a pound, it's worth two. It's a small give to increase the motor skills, confidence, and empower these children to develop a physical activity habit for life, really.
Doubling your money with just a single donation, that's fantastic.
Absolutely.
How do people do that then? How do they make those donations?
Right. Well, we're saying to people, don't do it yet. Do it from midday of Tuesday, the 27th of November. And if they go into the Big Give website, you just put in the word Big Give and it will come up. And then it asks you which charity to give to, and you put British Blind Sport, and then it's as simple as that. I actually tried it yesterday just to see how it worked, and then I thought, oh, I'm not making my donation yet, so I want it to be doubled. But the steps were really, really simple. It was really simple.
So there you go, make a difference to British Blind Sport's First Steps with the Big Give. Elena, best of luck with that, and thank you for telling us all about it on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much and happy Christmas to you.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Sight loss charity RNIB is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. And the charity has always championed advances in technology that help open up many avenues for blind and partially sighted people. Brian Negus has also championed accessible technology for the VI community and has himself benefited from accessible technologies as the years have gone on. And Brian joins me now on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Simon. Good to talk with you.
Now, you've been involved with accessible technologies quite extensively over the years, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I was born with a optic neuropathy, which was only picked up by a school teacher when I was around about 11, who realised that I couldn't see the board. And at that time, of course, the access technology ran to as much as a hand magnifier, which was quite useful. And it also gave me an excuse for getting out of geography lessons so that I could learn to play the double bass instead. So it has its advantages. When I went on to university, I was pretty disappointed. I ought to explain, by the way, I'm 70 now. So when I went to university, it was a long time ago. And I was kind of disappointed by the response to a student with sight loss. They really didn't have any idea at the time. Of course, universities are so much better now. And I've been steadily using more and more features of accessibility throughout a career, which turned out to be a career in computing. I ended up as Director of Computing Services at Loughborough University. I'm happy to tell you a little bit about that route.
Please do, yes.
Okay, well, throughout my working life, I've obviously had poor vision, which has been getting steadily worse. Now, the first technology that I used was simple optical technology. As I said, a magnifying glass. And then I moved on to magnifying spectacles, which worked quite well for me. I started with 3x magnification and I ended up with 12x magnification, which is as much as magnifying spectacles can handle. For early parts of my computing life, I was peering at screens with my nose virtually on the screen, and I was peering at the screen with those magnifying specs. Dreadful posture, gave me all sorts of backache, and it was really kind of uncomfortable. And then software, I was using Windows at the time, software like ZoomText became available, and for the first time, I could sit back and look at a magnified screen. That was amazing, and that was a huge step forward. It was also around then that I could begin to select text and have it read to me. So that was really, really good. So during my working life, I was mainly using Microsoft Windows with screen magnification and some screen reading, because I'm lucky enough to have enough sight that a heavily magnified screen works for me. Then, of course, came along much more accessible technology. And this is extraordinary, isn't it? The most accessible device I've got for IT and general digital inclusion is, in fact, a smartphone. At first sight, you'd have thought that a smartphone was an incredibly unaccessible device for people with sight loss. But the iPhone 3G was a device which I purchased and experimented with and was astonished at how I could do everything with that device without even bothering to look at the screen, because the entire voice over interface allowed me to simply hear what was going on. I didn't need to look at the screen. If I wanted to, I could, and I could see some things on the screen, but I had a device for the first time that I could fully access really very easily by learning voice over. It's not for everybody, but it works incredibly well for me. So I've seen this huge move from being dependent on simple optical devices all the way through now to be able to doing everything pretty much with a smartphone or a tablet. It's been an amazing journey.
And also, when accessibility is in a product like you've just mentioned, then it comes as standard with the product, which again is a game changer, because quite often this technology can be an expensive add-on to what you want to do.
I think that's the most significant thing that has changed over the years. That Apple, I think, pioneered this, but it's happening much more now. We are finding that standard consumer products already have the accessibility built in. Apple's iPhone, iPad, iMac. I understand now that the accessibility built into Windows products is now excellent. And, of course, we're also looking for consumer products. Maybe it won't be so long before pretty much every microwave and every oven is accessible to people with blindness. At the moment, you still have to go for rather specialized products. But I'm guessing that in the future, suppliers will begin to realize that there's a real market out there and they'll make their products hugely more accessible for us all.
Now, you mentioned that you're 70 years old now, Brian. I'm 55 this year. And even for me, when I'm listening to you talking about accessible technology, when I was a boy, I was watching things like Star Trek, the original Star Trek and things like that, where we dreamed of technology that was like speech, that would operate things, and it's actually starting to come about now. And it seems incredible how quickly that has moved in the last 50 years.
Absolutely. This development is focused around artificial intelligence, which is perhaps the most significant thing that's going to improve accessibility and assistive technology for people with sight loss. You and I both know about things like the wonderful iPhone app called Seeing AI, for instance, which we can just point our phone at text and have it read to us. We can have it recognize faces. We can have it recognize products. That's amazing, and that's all dependent on this voice technology. We also have things, as you said, like Siri and like Amazon Echoes, the devices which can do stuff for us just by speaking to them. I spend a lot of time training blind and partially sighted people to use technology, and I always begin with showing them the voice control features, which are so powerful now. They're really wonderful. By the way, something I did want to say is that a guy called Anirudh Kul, who was the team leader of the Seeing AI product, which is probably the most amazing product for the blind that's ever been, has now moved to Aira, which is a company that provides a very, very interesting service. It's a bit like something called Be My Eyes, but it's kind of Be My Eyes on steroids. It's a charged service, and it's not available in the UK at present. But what it does, the user wears a headset, which is effectively just a video camera, and that is connected to the user's phone. So the user can start up this service at any time, and the user gains access to a fully trained operator who knows exactly where the user is. They can see the environment around the user by looking at the phone, and they also have personal information about the user, like the kind of information they need. That service has been based on people in the past, but they've now recruited Anirudh to add artificial intelligence to that service, and I think that's going to be an absolute game changer. Things like that are coming, and they're so exciting. Currently, it costs at maximum around about £200 a month for that service. But then again, I was looking at the cost that guide dogs quote for the cost of a guide dog from birth to retirement. And I think that's about, what, £57,000. So that comes in at about 23 years of service for something like Aira. So I think maybe we will find ways of affording this kind of technology, and maybe charities will be able to help people gain access to it. Who knows? But it's all looking pretty exciting.
I think we're in a crossover generation, though, Brian, now, where I think accessible technology for younger people coming up with sight loss, it's going to be second nature. But there's still that crossover where that some of us are a bit reticent to try and get about and about technology and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's why things like Amazon's Echo Dots and Google Home Minis can be surprisingly useful and accessible for the older generation, people like me. But I've helped people aged 80 and above use those devices, and they have found them to be really very helpful. You obviously can't do everything with them, but you can do a lot with them. And in fact, one lady whom I'm working with, who's over 80, she got herself a Google Home Mini and then went on to acquire an iPhone, and she is now very proficient with that phone. So people can get there, but people have their own individual level. But typically, there's something there for pretty much everybody today. As RLB says a lot of the time, things like Amazon Echo is hugely accessible and can be used by pretty well everyone.
And, of course, we've got e-book readers now, which means that you can select nearly any kind of book that's available as an e-book and have it read to you by your device, which gives much more scope as well. And also, I know in your own personal life, you're a very keen photographer.
That's right.
Yeah, and technology has helped with that as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's helped enormously. I do need to use my magnifying spectacles, holding the camera's LCD screen up to those spectacles to see, to take the photographs. But then when I get back home, the magnifying technology on my Mac computer helps me to work on those photographs and subsequently publish them. And I've had a huge amount of fun with that. Better still, there was somebody I was working with recently, a young man who had actually given up photography because of the loss of his sight. He actually had Leber's, which is a condition similar to mine. I showed him how I worked, and bless him, he has bought himself a camera again and has started up again. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, so, I mean, accessible technology is great for the, what you suppose you call the serious things in life, opening up things, preserving independence, reading a letter that's come through the door and all these sort of things. But again, also in this kind of recreational and creative way, it's helping with that as well.
It certainly is. At the very simplest level, there are also plenty of accessible games now. If you look at the various the communications forums, people are having a lot of fun playing games that are made accessible to the visually impaired. But it's just kind of endless. It's not just about digital inclusion. It's about helping us lead our everyday lives and do all the stuff that everybody else does. That's just it.
So we've been looking back at the advances over the last 150 years, and I think really exponentially the last 50 years has been incredible. You've touched on this with the AI, artificial intelligence, but where would you like to see it going now over the next 150 years?
Well, really would like to see a huge growth in accessibility being built into standard consumer products. It started, but it's got a long way to go. But when it comes to assistive technology, I really do think that artificial intelligence is probably one of the most important things that's going to contribute, along with wearable technology. It's always a little inconvenient to have to clank around with a load of devices in a bag. And as wearable technology, things like Orcam, things like Aira come along, then I think this is probably the way of the future. I know that the Seeing AI team, when they first developed the project, envisaged it as a wearable product eventually. So I think that's where we're heading. We'll just clamp on some device and it will talk to us. It will help us get around. It'll tell us what that notice on the shop door is saying. It's wonderful. I'm sure that will happen, and I'm sure it won't take 150 years to happen. So I haven't a clue what will be happening in 150 years' time. I won't be here to see it, obviously. But I think AI will have made a huge impact. I think we're going to have many more accessible products, not just, of course, for people with sight loss, but for people with hearing loss and other disabilities. And I think that's a wonderful future to look forward to.
And on that note, Brian Negus, thank you so much for sharing your views on accessible technology, and here's to the future.
It's been a pleasure talking to you again, Simon.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.
Certainly are. That's it for us for the podcast, though. Back tomorrow on air from 10 and on the podcast from 5. See you then.
The Daily Connect Podcast.